From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As of today, more than half of the states in this country have activated their National Guard after widespread protests over the death of George Floyd. In New York City today, Governor Andrew Cuomo called for a national ban on excessive force. In Washington, D.C., Mayor Muriel Bowser announced a two-day curfew starting tonight at 7, following weekend protests there that started peacefully. But eventually led to chaos outside of the White House, where parked cars and an historic church were set on fire.
In Flint, Michigan, Genesee County Sheriff Chris Swanson told protesters over the weekend that his officers were different from the officers charged in George Floyd's death.
Don't think for a second that he represents who these cops are from all over the county and around this nation. We go out there to help people, not do that nonsense.
There we go.
Meanwhile, here in Los Angeles County, business owners throughout the region have been taking stock of the damage in places like downtown L.A. and Santa Monica. And Frank Stoltz is a public safety correspondent for KPCC. He joins us from L.A. And Frank, you were out over the weekend at the protests. There were curfews implemented, including one that started actually at 6 p.m. last night, different from the 8 p.m. Curfew the previous night. What did you see when you were out there?
Well, I think what's notable about the protests over the weekend is their spread. The initial protests Wednesday, Thursday, Friday were really restricted to downtown Los Angeles. But on Saturday, they spread to the Fairfax District, to Melrose Avenue, and then out to Santa Monica and the beach cities, including Long Beach. Which is, of course, the second largest city in Los Angeles County. It's about 500,000 people. People forget that sometimes. And there were fires, police cars were burned. And while the vast majority of the folks who were out there were peaceful protesters, it did indeed turn violent. I was in downtown Los Angeles Saturday night, the hotspot for some of the most violent activities. I was at 8th and Broadway and witnessed a large group of looters break into a Foot Locker. It was a chaotic scene. There was a bike stand on fire outside. It was about 9, 10 o'clock at night. As one group of folks came out, one fella threatened to shoot people in the crowd if they didn't get out of the way. Turns out he and another man were carrying out a safe, and there was a pickup truck parked nearby, and they carried that safe to the truck. So clearly there was some organized crime involved here.
Again,
you know, most of the protests, of course, were peaceful.
Yeah. You know, there's a history here with the riots after the Rodney King verdict back in 1992 that's fresh on folks' mind here. How would you describe the police response?
Compared to 1992, there were a couple of similarities. In 1992, after the acquittal of the officers who beat Rodney King, police were reluctant to move forcefully initially because they knew that people were angry. The relationship between the LAPD and communities was poor. And that really kind of set the tone for the 4 or 5 days of rioting because they backed off. They were not aggressive. We saw that again this time around, but for a different reason. The LAPD has improved since then. Its relationship with the community is better, and they were reluctant to move in because they were attempting to practice de-escalation restraint. We should note, we'd be remiss if we didn't, that there were a lot of there's been a lot of criticism of the LAPD for too quickly using tear gas and rubber bullets. And
we actually heard about one of your colleagues.
Yeah, exactly.
Was hit with a rubber bullet while he was out covering the protests yesterday.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. In Long Beach, and it was the Long Beach Police Department, which is notable because reforms there have been slower, fired at my colleague Adolfo Guzman Lopez, or at least in his direction, and hit him in the throat with a rubber bullet. He's okay. But it is one of several stories where people say they were just going about their business, either protesting or doing their job as journalists, and were hit by police.
That's Frank Stoltz. He's public safety correspondent for KPCC. Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, today, President Trump held a conference call with governors in which he urged tougher crackdowns on violence. Joining us for the latest is NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tam, the president told the governors they are making themselves look like fools. Tell us more about what happened on this call.
Yeah, so at times the call seems to have gotten testy based on our reporting at NPR. I acquired a partial transcript of the call, and in an exchange with Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, Pritzker called on President Trump to provide more leadership, that he said he was concerned by the rhetoric that Trump had been using. Trump's response was, "I don't like your rhetoric much either," and criticized his handling of the coronavirus. President Trump in this call really urging the governors to be more aggressive, to stop these protests, particularly the violent aspects of the protests, and to call on the military. He says, "We have a wonderful military," according to a source.
The president talked about the protests that were going on over the death of George Floyd at the SpaceX launch, which happened on Saturday. Listen.
"We will stand with the family of George Floyd, with the peaceful protesters, and with every law-abiding citizen who wants decency, civility, safety, and security."
So that's what the president said there. But he's also been calling the protesters or the rioters thugs, anarchists. Is there a consistent message coming from the White House about what the president believes about the people who have gone out in huge numbers across the country?
Well, the president is clearly drawing a distinction between people who are protesting peacefully, who are upset about what happened to George Floyd, and then the protests that get more violent, the burning of cars and buildings and looting. And he is trying to draw a distinction there in his public remarks. I'll say, though, that that speech that he delivered on Saturday at the SpaceX launch is the last time we have heard from the president, except, via reports of this call that he had with governors. A lot has happened between Saturday afternoon, when the president last spoke, and now. And the president, of course, has tweeted a lot and is clearly, while wanting to support or say he supports peaceful protesters, also pushing hard on this idea of law and order and wanting to crack down on violent protesters.
You know, we also have not heard a whole lot from Republican senators, maybe with the exception of Senator Tim Scott, who's the only Black Republican in the Senate, who said yesterday that some of the president's tweets were not, quote, constructive. What have lawmakers been saying about the protests?
You know, it's a real mixed bag. You have people like Marco Rubio talking about how they sort of striking a similar balance to the president about peaceful protesters should be able to get out there, but also arguing that Antifa is real. Antifa is this loose group, not really an organization, that anti-fascists, but that have been connected to violent incidents. He's saying Antifa is real. You can't downplay that. President Trump obviously also pushing this idea of Antifa. And then you have people like Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, who says that the anarchy, rioting, and looting needs to end tonight, suggesting that, you know, the 101st Airborne Division might be enough to push off Antifa. So some real strong calls from some Republicans to be tougher.
The president has also been tweeting out some very short tweets, including just the words "law and order." Is that a political strategy?
All caps, exclamation point. That's a pretty standard operation from President Trump. But yes, he is, you know, he ran on the idea that he was going to be a law and order president, that you wouldn't see these sort of things when he was president. And now there are protests in the street again. And he is pushing the idea that he's the law and order guy, and Democrats, if you elect Democrats, this sort of anarchy that you see right now, you'll have all the time. That's the argument he's making. It's a weird argument for an incumbent president in his third year in office to be making, but he's still sort of pushing the idea of himself as an outsider.
Just about 30 seconds left here, Tam, but Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, did emerge from lockdown today to address community leaders at a black church. Just tell us about how his actions have contrasted with President Trump's.
Well, so he's been out with the people. He also went to Wilmington yesterday at the site of some of the protests to see and talk to people. He's doing a lot of listening. He's surrounding himself with black leaders at this church who were at times pushing back on him and saying that Democrats need to do more. And you have President Trump taking this other tack, pushing more of a law and order type idea, not talking about systemic racism or systemic problems with police brutality. They are basically running as the candidates that they are right. running as. I mean, this is a pretty clear representation yeah. of what they're running on.
Even as the protests for racial justice in many American cities have dominated the headlines, the coronavirus pandemic continues, as does the process of reopening parts of the country. Today, bowling alleys, gyms, and movie theaters are back in business in Kentucky. So are dental offices in New York and hotels and beaches in South Florida. Meanwhile, the CDC has issued guidance to discourage cities from breaking up homeless encampments to avoid spreading the coronavirus by doing so. Several communities in Northern California have responded by setting up and managing camps in parking lots to maintain social distance for unsheltered homeless people. Joining us now is Jenny Lynn Holmes, who is the Chief Program Officer for Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Santa Rosa. She's managing a camp in that city. Jenny Lynn, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of how the camp in Santa Rosa is set up. What does it look like and who's living there?
Yeah, so it's at the Finley Community Center that focuses on a lot of different activities. It's in a small part of the parking lot. It's kind of tucked a little bit away. There's 68 tents that have been erected. They all kind of match and were coordinated to do so to kind of create a calming environment when you walk in. There's several regular restrooms, hand washing stations. We've got security on site, staff on site. We have medical support coming in 4 days a week to do testing, but also to just provide regular access to healthcare. We have a shower trailer. Right now we've got cooling stations because it got up to 90 degrees in our community. Each tent is actually 12 feet apart from one another, which is in accordance with the CDC guidance, is that all tents should be 12 feet apart. So it's been a good alternative for people who just didn't have access to be even able to follow the health guidelines because they just didn't have the resources to do so.
And how many people are there?
We are over half full. We've been open for just over a week. So we've been slowly moving individuals in. You know, there's a lot of coordination and logistics to find the people, keep them engaged, you know where they're going to be at any given moment, help them pack up their belongings and transport them over. But our outreach team has been doing a great job.
And are people maintaining social distance and wearing masks while they're in the camps?
Yes. So everyone has been very good at following all of the guidelines. There's been a lot of education we've been doing. As you know, people experiencing homelessness don't always have the same access to media and resources in terms of knowing what's going on. So we've been keeping them up to date on what the changing guidelines have been. And for the most part, people are just really grateful to have a safe place to be. You know, and it's not even just being safe from the potential spread of COVID-19, but also just safety in general. We've had several people in there who have a long history of being sexually assaulted on the streets, and this now provides them safety and an ability to, you know, kind of take that next step in their what they're trying to do to get out of homelessness. We've got a large majority of people that are actually working and, you know, just can't afford to live here, but are actively working in our community and now have a place to sleep. You know, one guy he works graveyard shifts, so now he goes to his job at night and then comes and sleeps at the tent in the morning. Wow. And, you know, has now a safe place to kind of do those things. So that's been a great benefit, as well as really preventing the spread of COVID-19 and allowing our outreach staff to work on what ultimately is our biggest goal and the city's biggest goal, which is to house these individuals and to get them out of homelessness permanently.
And has anyone there gotten COVID-19?
So far, none. Not even in any of our other shelters that Catholic Charities operates. We've had no positive cases yet, and we hope to continue that way. We pivoted quickly to put in more preventative measures to try to address the potential spread among our shelters. And so far, we have not had a positive case in any of the programs we operate.
Now, Jenny Lynn, we had you on the show a few years ago after Santa Rosa was hit hard by those wildfires. 3,000 homes were lost, and you were worried about a second wave of homelessness because of a lack of affordable housing. Now, given everything that's happened, and especially the economic situation, how big is the homeless issue there at the moment?
Well, right now, homelessness, it's hard to know exactly the numbers, but I know that we have, anecdotally noticed an increase. But where I am most nervous is not what's happening right now. It's what's going to happen in the next 3 to 6 months. This is really just the beginning of the crisis. For us, the crisis is on its way. Everything that's happening, whether it comes to, the loss of jobs, the businesses that are going to be closing, the lack of childcare options for people, it's all of these are indicators of future increases in homelessness. And we start to see people come into our food access programs, and the numbers have more than doubled of people coming to seek food access. And that's another indicator to us that that's one of the first places people reach out to before they get to the stage of homelessness. And so we're trying to raise the alarm quickly and loudly that we have got to get ahead of it, and we've got to get preventative measures in place, or we're going to be experiencing a surge in homelessness like this nation's never seen.
That is Jenny Lynn Holmes, who is Chief Program Officer for Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Santa Rosa. She is overseeing a homeless camp in the city during the pandemic. Jenny Lynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
This week, the governor of Hawaii has extended a mandate for all visitors of the island to self-quarantine for 14 days through June 30th. Hawaii has been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic, not in the number of cases. They actually report just over 600. That's the lowest count of any state in the U.S. But by the severe decline in tourism, the island's number one industry. And this decline has also had an impact on the island's food supply, 90% of which is imported. Albie Miles is the assistant professor of sustainable community food systems at the University of Hawaii, West Oahu, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Albie, it's important to understand the history behind why Hawaii imports 90% of its food. But before we go there, the decline of tourism because of the coronavirus has really had a profound impact on residents there. We're reading that one-third of the state's working population has filed for unemployment, and food banks are overwhelmed by this need. And all of this is exacerbated by a disruption in the food supply chain there. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so as a result of COVID-19, there's a profound contraction in the Hawaii state economy with the loss of tourism dollars. And as a result of that loss of income, that loss of purchasing power, we're seeing a spike in household food insecurity, where there are long lines of people waiting to get emergency food from our food banks and other emergency food distributors.
Mm. There is a history here that there's been a decline over the decades, particularly in agriculture, which actually leads to that 90% of imports for Hawaii. Can you tell us more about that history?
The history of food system change in Hawaii begins really with Western contact in the late 1700s. Hawaii, prior to Western contact, was entirely food self-sufficient. And as a result of the development of the sugarcane industry in Hawaii, there was a fundamental transformation of land and water use in the state, leading to sugar being a primary export. And so both the collapse of the Hawaiian population and reorientation of the Hawaii economy from one of self-subsistence to one of export fundamentally transformed the nature of Hawaii's economy and the nature of agricultural land use in Hawaii. We're always going to be importing sizable amounts of food into the state, but that kind of commodity chain and that infrastructure that gets food to our plates is relatively brittle.
You actually surveyed farmers to get a sense of how they're doing. What were some of their concerns?
Yeah, so you're right in that cost of production for farmers in Hawaii is very high because of high land cost, high electricity cost. But the thing that we found in surveying farmers across the state is they identified the key obstacles to their contributing to the state goal of doubling food production was access to affordable land, increase the scale of their operation or start new operation, and access to skilled labor, as well as additional technical consulting services to help them address some of the significant pests and disease problems that we have here in the state due to the climate and the importation of many invasive exotic species. And then, of course, the growers here in the state are in competition with the imports that are coming in from, say, California agriculture, where the scale of production is many times larger than is achievable here in the state of Hawaii.
But now that there's been a steep decline in visitors, is the conversation around rebuilding an agricultural economy a realistic one in the short term? It seems to be a long-term idea that everyone seems to be on board with. But can you talk about this?
So in the short term, there's a need on the part of growers in the state of Hawaii to receive some additional federal stimulus to make sure that they're economically viable. And then over the longer term, there's important conversations being had about how can we really tap the tourism industry as it is restored so that the tourism industry serves as an engine of food system development here in Hawaii. So we need to survey the tourism industry as it is being restored to determine exactly what is that industry willing to support in terms of purchasing from local agriculturalists to develop the local agricultural economy.
That's Albie Miles. He is the Assistant Professor of Sustainable Community Food Systems at the University of Hawaii, West Oahu. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The United States border with Canada stretches more than 5,000 miles, and in many states, communities on both sides of this border are intertwined with each other, culturally, historically, and economically. COVID-19, however, has led the two countries to suspend non-essential travel across the border, temporarily severing many of those connections. Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg visited one border town to see how lives and livelihoods are being affected.
Gary Terrio hops off his motorcycle and walks into the Tasty Freeze in Madawaska, Maine. It's a roadside ice cream and takeout stand, just a short hop from the Canadian border.
Do I have a number or something? Yeah, 7. Yeah.
As he waits for his milkshake, Terrio peers across the St. John River towards Edmundston, New Brunswick, less than a mile away. He says these communities have long been linked by their connected economies and shared heritage.
Well, a good example is my mother was born in Edmundston, which is right across the border. My father was born in Van Buren. And so half my relatives are over there and the other half are over here. So there's a lot of back and forth, visiting aunts, uncles, grandparents. There was always a back and forth on the border.
Since the 1970s, the population in Madawaska has fallen to less than 4,000 as the local paper mill has laid off workers. But residents say the town's relationship with its Canadian neighbors has helped keep it afloat. Americans go to Edmundston to see family, gamble at the casino, or get a haircut. Canadians come to Madawaska for the cheaper gas and milk. But most of those visits came to a halt 2 months ago, when the U.S. and Canada blocked non-essential travel across the border. Terrio says he can still cross at times to get parts for his garage door business. But other travel, like to see family, has stopped.
So I was crossing every day. I was residing there and working here. So I did a lot of it every day, crossing every day. And then when the decision came that they were closing the borders, because my business is probably 95% in the States, we made the decision at that time to stay here until things can iron themselves out.
And with visits from Canadian customers having evaporated, many businesses in Madawaska, including gas stations and convenience stores, have been hit hard. Less than a mile from the local border crossing, Tim Lozier has run Bob's Service Center with his sister for about 25 years.
probably 60% of my business is Canadians. So when they close the bridge down, we let our workers go. So it's just my sister and I working the store now. And it's been like that for 2 months. And it looks like it's going to be like that for another month. And, I mean, I've lost probably 2,500 people coming through the door a week.
Lozier says he understands the need to maintain restrictions and protect public health. But he worries that even if the border does reopen soon, some of his regular Canadian shoppers will still be hesitant to come over.
And people are going to be scared to come over here. Or, you know, I don't think we're going to, you know, it'll be back to normal. It might take 5 or 6 years, I think.
The concerns have led some local business owners and even a state legislator in Maine to push for the federal government to reopen parts of the border, pointing to low COVID-19 counts in both New Brunswick and rural Maine. But federal officials have said the border will remain closed to non-essential travel until at least June 22nd, and it won't be permitted until the administration is, quote, convinced that doing so is safe and secure. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Feinberg in Madawaska, Maine.
The nationwide call to action against police brutality and racism has similar parallels to a long, hot summer 53 years ago, when about 160 riots erupted here in the United States. For more, we're joined by Carvell Wallace, a New York Times bestselling author who wrote and edited a series remembering the 50th anniversary of the 1967 riots. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, so you're right that for Black people in America, the psychic toll of having to tie your fate, the fate of your family, to a world designed to control you can only be withstood for so long. Eventually, inevitably, you write, a truer, more direct action calls, and often that action is abrupt, it's violent, and it's loud. And you call it a spiritual impulse. Can you say more?
Yeah, I call it a spiritual impulse because there's a fundamental disconnect that happens when you live as a Black person in America. You're told that there's rule of law. You're told that you have to believe that your life matters in order for you to show up every day for your job and to raise your children. And yet your experience continues to belie that. You continue to be lied to and in effect gaslit by reality. And most Black people are living in this state of trying to hold those two completely opposing realities. And eventually there comes a time when you have to see something that brings those two together. And what I see when I see uprisings and people and flames and people setting things on fire and people taking to the streets is that that feeling of chaos, that feeling of seeing things destroyed, in some sense, is the only thing that makes sense. It verifies that this whole system that has been lying to you about your involvement in it, the mask is taken off. You know, for me, this is not to like justify or even condone it. I don't really have an opinion. I mean, my job as a writer is not to tell people what to do, but to understand why people do what we do. And that's an important difference. And so what I understand is that when you see the things, the systems, the institutions, and capitalism is a major player in that institution, when you see those things destroyed, when you see those windows broken and those fire alarms going off and those sprinklers raining down and everything, what you're seeing is something that is satisfying because you're like, that's what my experience is of this reality. Mm. It's a broken, chaotic, destructive reality.
How do you think the understanding of this reality and really this action to riot changes based on how far removed you are from this reality?
You can talk about that far removal in two ways. You can talk about it sort of politically or physically. And what I write in the piece is that if you're watching this, you know, most Americans, even though there were these 100 and some odd riots, uprisings, whatever one likes to call them, I think those words do hold meaning. I think when you're watching those from the news, from your living room, what you're saying is, wow, like this doesn't make any sense. They're burning their own communities. Or even if you're somewhat sympathetic to the cause, you're saying, well, they just don't have any other choice. You know, they're doing this wrong thing, but I feel for them. But when you are in it, when you are living that reality, you're experiencing something much more present. these actions are not a political strategy. They're an outward expression of something that is burning within you. And one, spiritually, one needs to see what is happening inside represented outside in order to feel whole.
Carvel, all throughout the weekend, I saw on social media a narrative emerging that romanticizes the civil rights movement as peaceful, that summer of 1967. It's a framing of what happened back then as the more powerful and correct way to protest. What do you think people need to remember about that time?
Everyone knows that Martin Luther King is like associated with nonviolent protest. And it's important to remember that that nonviolent protest was largely a strategic approach that he championed and saw the power of and that had some impact. But I think it's also quite important to remember that the impact of nonviolent protest was greatly bolstered by the threat of violent protest. In other words, Martin Luther King doesn't make progress if Malcolm X doesn't exist, right? Because if in this country, well, in not even in this country, in all of history, no oppressor has given up power without threat. It's that would call nonviolence calls on the morality of an oppressor. And if the oppressor had such morality, the oppression wouldn't exist in the first place. That's just the nature of the thing. And so you can argue whether or not that there's strategic advantages to nonviolence. And I think that there are some. But I also think that, you know, people have conveniently forgotten that nonviolence works in tandem with the threat or perhaps the existence of potential violence. And I think that's what people are missing from that civil rights movement.
As a journalist, something I'm thinking about is not just this historical framing, but also how headlines are framing what's happening across our country. Over the weekend, Slate had a notable one. It said, police erupt in violence. Mm-hmm. And on Twitter, you actually called for police to be considered as counter-protesters. Can you say more about this power of framing?
You know, what I was trying to say there is not that police should be considered counter-protesters. It's that by default, they are, if the protest is against police brutality. Right. I mean, you can argue that police are law enforcement if you're protesting, say, for, you know, to stop global warming or something of this nature. And you can argue that the police are there to make sure that things stay lawful and that people have the right to assemble. I don't know if that's true, but you can argue that. But if the protest is against the power of a violent police state whose job it is to protect property at the expense of lives, particularly lives of poor black and brown people, then the police are by definition counter-protesters. At the very least, you'd have to say that they have split interests. They have a conflict of interest because they're there, quote unquote, to keep the peace, but they're also, their presence is the exact thing that you're organizing against. And so I said that to help people understand what they were seeing.
In terms of thinking about history, today is the 99th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre. Yeah. Yeah. It was one of the deadliest acts of violence in our country. What do you think, based on your work, thinking about the context of this moment, how are you going to describe what is now being called one of the worst civil unrest in decades?
As a writer, your job is simply to say what you see truthfully in the moment. And the reason you have to do that is because you can't go back and change what you said. Once you've said it, you say it. So I would like to believe that what I will say in the future is the same thing I'm saying now. I don't know if that's true, but I would like to believe that. And so what I would say in the future is that that there is a constant battle between the need of people to be free and to be human. To live full humanity. That means safety, love, connection, to live honestly, to have honesty as part of their lived experience. There's a battle between that on one hand and a force of oppression that needs people to be subjugated in order for it to continue. Capitalism does that. It needs people to be subjugated. Patriarchy, white supremacy, it needs people to be subjugated. There's a constant battle between that. And I think what we're seeing today in this moment is very strong pushback against those oppressive forces. And that this pushback is absolutely a result of what's happened with COVID and You know, it's a continuation of Black Lives Matter, but it's also a continuation of Occupy. There is a large scale change in the way that people are thinking about how this country operates and treats its citizenry. And it is, I know it's fashionable to say, for people to be cynical, and there's a very strong argument made for Afro-pessimism, which I, just as a writer, really like reading about. But my experience over the last, I'm 46 years old, and I've seen a tremendous shift in the way that average people talk about this and understand the machinations of systemic oppression. I'm not saying that I'm hopeful about it. I'm just saying I've seen that more average people grasp the way this system actually works. Will that bring about change? I don't know, because it calls on white people and members of oppressive groups to give up power. Men have to give up power, not share power, not let other people have some power, but be willing to give up power. White people have to be willing to give up the power that this society affords them by nature of their birth. And I don't know if when the rubber meets the road, if people will do it, but I know that that's what is necessary for change to happen.
That's Carvel Wallace, New York Times bestselling author and podcaster. Carvel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we want to take a few minutes to remember the artist Christo, born Christo Yavachev, who died yesterday at his home in New York City. He was known for his massive temporary public art projects, which he created along with his late wife, Jean-Claude. They included surrounding islands in Miami's Biscayne Bay with hot pink fabric, wrapping the Reichstag in Berlin, and installing thousands of saffron-colored gates in Central Park. The UK's Tate Gallery said in a tweet that the pair dreamed up what seemed impossible and changed the way we look at the world. I spoke with Christo in June 2016 about his project Floating Piers. It was a walkway covered with yellow-orange fabric that stretched almost 2 miles into Lake Iseo in Italy, connecting two islands with the mainland. From June 18th to July 3rd that year, the project had an estimated 1.2 million visitors. I asked Christo, why not leave Floating Piers up permanently?
All our projects, they're designed to be temporary. There are some permanent works, you know, works where the museum and collection, they're permanent, they stay forever. But that project, they're not only designed temporary, they're designed for a particular season of the year. Like the Central Park project was winter project. We like to have a leafless tree to see the gates. During the summertime, Central Park is like forest. When the Miami project and Florida 1983 surrounded island was spring project, because before the hurricanes come in Miami later in the season. And of course, that project is summer project, the Floating Pier. We have the longest daylight of the year, end of June. All the journey is the work of art. All the journey from the beginning to the end is the work of art. And the most beautiful part of Floating Pier that I discover is to see entire project is about the people walking nowhere. About the feeling of the surface of the land or the water. And your feet, actually many of the people walk barefoot. And they walk. It's not like going to shop, not going to see your friends. It's going really nowhere.
And what was it like in this case to complete this project without your longtime wife and partner, Jean-Claude, who died in 2009?
I miss her all the time, you know. She loved that project very much. She was a very dynamic woman. No, she was never stop. She can never sit. She's moving all the time. And she was really very energetic. And of course, this is why this project is so much still with her, you know.
I read that the two of you wouldn't fly on the same planes because one of the planes crashed, you wanted to make sure that the other person would be able to continue the work.
Exactly, yes.
So what's next? You've talked about the Mastaba, this permanent project, right?
You asked me to talk about the future and very unfortunate moment. I have only remaining few days to be with our baby. I don't like to think about anything else except that project. I have these 16 days to enjoy it from morning to night, the middle of the night. It's all about that project.
You talk about how this project can be felt by those who are able to walk along it. But I also want to say that one of the amazing images that I've seen, or many of them, are from the air. That, and a lot of your projects, they look really incredible, and you see them in a different way from above.
But really, the project should be walk. Of course, for the photograph, for the newspaper, they're photographing for the air. And much of the pictures there before the project is open on June 18th. Today, you cannot see anything of that. We see it from helicopter. It's full. It's like an incredible amount of people. And this is the most greatest pleasure. It's entirely motion of people walking.
So you don't think about what it's going to look like from above?
No, I enjoy it. I never take the helicopter, actually, really. I have no time. Entire project is designed, basically, it's like a huge boulevard or avenue. And this is why, against that organic shape of the island and curve, organic shape, you have this very straight line created, rencontre of several piers, like an area called the star, when three piers meet together. I just coming back on the boat when I was looking from the boat how that connection happened. It's very exciting. It's an incredible play of the immensity of the water with people walking in the water. The color of the fabric is dahlia yellow, but around the edge of the pier is continually wet, and of course the color is darker, mostly orangey, like a brick dark color orangey, with very painterly surface. And the people do not walk on the wet side. They really walk on the dry side. It's almost like abstract painting.
Is this the project that you're most proud of that you've ever done?
No, all of our projects, they're part of our life, you know. They're part of moment of our life, Jean-Claude and myself.
Well, Christo, congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Christo, speaking with me in June 2016, he died yesterday in New York City at the age of 84. Per Christo and Jean-Claude's wishes, the pair's final work, wrapping the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, is scheduled to debut in September 2021. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.